Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for holding. The conference will start in just a few minutes. Thank you for your patience. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Solar Market Insight Quarter Three 2012 conference call presented by Solar Energy Industries Association and GTM Research. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If you would like to have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at any time. This will place your question or comment in the order it was received. I would now like to turn the conference call over to your host for today, Ron Resch. Ron, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mary, and welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us this morning. I'm Ron Resch, President and CEO of the Solar Energy Industries Association, also known as SEIA, based here in Washington, D.C. SEIA is a nonprofit trade association representing 1,000 member companies operating in the United States from across the entire supply chain, serving all technologies in all markets, including residential, commercial, and utility clients. Today, we will discuss the continued growth of the U.S. solar energy market as detailed in the third quarter U.S. Solar Market Insight Report released today by SEIA and GTM Research. First, I will give a high-level overview of the trends driving the industry's robust growth and the policies needed to maintain it. Then we'll hear from Andrew Krolowitz, Senior Analyst for GTM Research. Andrew will provide a deeper dive into the report findings, covering the various solar technologies and market segments. Next, we'll hear from two industry leaders who can speak how the trends we're seeing in the industry have impacted their company. We're joined by Jonathan Abbe, Senior Vice President and Market Development for NextAmp, and Nat Kramer, CEO of Clean Power Finance. Finally, we will open up the call to your questions after our remarks. For background, the Solar Market Insight Report is a quarterly publication produced by SEIA and GTM Research that surveys installers, manufacturers, utilities, and state agencies to collect data on photovoltaic solar systems and concentrating solar power technologies, as well as the solar energy industry's three primary market segments: residential, commercial, and utility scale. The report identifies current trends in U.S. solar demand, manufacturing, and pricing by state and market segments. The report then uses these trends to forecast demand over the next 5 years. At our website, www.seia.org/SMI, you can access a free executive summary of the report, a fact sheet summarizing key findings with additional charts, and information on how to purchase the full report. Our audio format today could not accommodate slides, so we have also posted the presentation slides provided by John Abbe from NextAmp that he will reference during his comments. So you may want to get to that page before we get to that segment. Again, that's www.sia.org/SMI for the PDF of John's slides. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. Today's report shows us that the solar industry is experiencing another year of record growth. During the first three quarters of 2012, more solar was installed than in all of 2011. Today, there is more than 6.4 gigawatts of solar electric capacity operating in the United States. That's enough power for over 1 million average U.S. households. A good deal of the solar industry's growth is being driven by the proliferation of the distributed generation market, and we'll hear more about that later. This quarter, for the first time ever, more than 90% of the residential systems installed in Arizona were third-party owned, either PPAs or leased systems. The industry expects this to be a continuing trend in states where consumers have this option available to them. And today, the top 10 solar states with respect to cumulative installations are, in order, California, New Jersey, Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Florida, Massachusetts, and North Carolina, most of which offer this third-party option. Today, there are 22 states that allow third-party power purchase agreements, and those states encouraging this type of system are experiencing more solar developments than any other. We're seeing this distributed generation growth partially thanks to the fact that the cost of a solar panel and the cost of the average solar energy system continue to decline. Since the beginning of 2011, the average cost of a PV panel has fallen by over 50%, while the average cost of a solar PV energy system has come down more than 30%. In fact, average system prices are down in each market segment quarter over quarter. All of this data tells us a story about what we've known for a long time. More Americans are seeing a value proposition of solar than ever before. As prices continue to decline and innovative financing models take hold in the marketplace, more American businesses and families see the benefits of going solar. So what's next for the U.S. solar market? Our new report predicts a strong fourth quarter. Overall, SEIA expects that 2012 annual growth will top 70% over 2011, bringing our industry to a record 3.2 gigawatts of newly installed solar during this calendar year. And we expect 2013 to be even better. SEIA has a public industry goal that we've been very outright about, and it's targeted to reach an installation of 10 gigawatts of capacity per year by 2015. Right now, we're tracking slightly below that goal, but we remain convinced that it's achievable if smart policies are in place at the federal and state level. In summary, our third quarter data indicates that, despite challenges, 2012 has been an outstanding year for the solar industry, and 2013 will be even stronger. Quarter over quarter, year after year, the solar industry is growing rapidly across all market segments and creating tens of thousands of new American jobs. With the right policies in place, we can continue this growth for years to come. I'd now like to pass it to Andrew Krulowitz of GTM Research, who will provide more in-depth coverage of the numbers from the report and what they mean for the solar industry going forward. Andrew?
Thanks, Roan. As Roan mentioned, I am a solar analyst at GTM Research, the wholly owned market research and analysis subsidiary of Green Tech Media, the online B2B clean tech news website. With that said, the U.S. market installed 684 megawatts of new capacity in the third quarter of 2012. This is up 44% from the same quarter last year. But on the very highest level, it's less than the 775 megawatts that were installed in Q2 2012. The high-level number is significantly affected by utility installations, so that can fluctuate pretty significantly quarter over quarter. But on the distributed side, residential and non-residential systems were up quarter over quarter and year over year. Looking at the market by segment, residential had its biggest quarter ever with 119 megawatts of new solar capacity installed. This represents 12% growth quarter over quarter and 62% growth year over year. These numbers were largely propped up by California, which had its largest quarter ever and installed more than 50 megawatts of residential solar, and also Arizona and New Jersey. As Roan mentioned, the third-party ownership model and the companies that offer financing solutions is really driving the market, especially in the states that I just mentioned. As Roan mentioned, there's more than 90% penetration of third-party ownership in Arizona, more than 75% in California, and in growing markets such as Massachusetts, we're seeing that number up above the 60% mark. Additionally, the installation prices and costs for these third-party ownership model companies continue to fall in line with direct-to-consumer installations. And in some cases, such as the case of California, they're being reported at even lower prices than direct-to-consumer installations. Reason for this being is a lot of these companies are now have achieved a certain size and significance with regard to installations, and they're able to streamline their processes and have a larger purchasing power. Overall, we expect continued growth in the residential market segment, especially in California and Arizona. And it's interesting to note that in these states, the rebates are nearly gone for residential systems, but the high avoided cost or the significant levels of solar installation ensure energy savings to homeowners just utilizing the 30% ITC. On the non-residential side, which includes commercial, government, and nonprofit installations, we saw a significant rebound in Q3 from a low Q2 installed base. This was led primarily, again, by California, which had significant recovery, and also Massachusetts. California installations bounced back from a very weak Q2, and it's interesting to note that a number of non-residential systems were installed in IOU territory that did not apply for the CSI rebate. This means that system costs have come down far enough and the rebate is now low enough that it's not a major factor for some customers who are looking to go solar. For all intents and purposes, solar is now completely competitive with grid prices with a 30% ITC. Massachusetts was another big story in the quarter. The state installed more than 36 megawatts of non-residential solar, the state's largest quarter ever, and it really helped prop up the state's overall number as well. I'll let John Abe from NextAmp speak a little bit more about this in a few minutes, but we expect even stronger growth in Q4, especially with this mild weather we've been having. Like the residential market segment, system costs have continued to fall significantly across the board in the non-residential markets, especially in states such as New Jersey and Massachusetts, where SREC prices, solar renewable energy credits, have been falling, and installers need to ensure that they're delivering the best product to the system owner. So it's not uncommon to see construction quotes in the low to mid $2 a watt range, and on the quarter, non-residential system costs fell for the 10th consecutive quarter to a new low of $4.18 a watt on average across the country. On the utility scale side, there were 21 utility projects completed in the third quarter of 2012, ranging in size from 300 kilowatts up to 115 megawatts. Most notable among these projects were phases of some of the largest in development in the country, including Agua Caliente in Arizona, and California Valley Solar Ranch in California. There are currently 2.1 gigawatts of utility PV projects operating in the U.S., and just about 10 gigawatts of projects with signed PPAs that are not yet operating but in various stages of development. Of the 10 gigawatts of projects with signed PPAs, 3 of those gigawatts come from the 10 largest projects that are currently under construction, all of which will be selling power to utilities in California. With this much capacity under development and with accelerating construction timelines, we here at GTM Research expect a rush of installations in Q4 and the final installed figure on the utility scale side to be near 775 megawatts in the fourth quarter of 2012. As Rode mentioned, the price of components continues to fall across the board. Modules on average in the U.S. from U.S. manufacturers are about 75 cents a watt in the third quarter of 2012, which is very competitive. Cells and wafers also fell, as did the price of inverters. These falling component costs, in addition to the Q4 rush that is typically experienced in the U.S. market this year, especially since a lot of the Treasury 1603 Treasury grant projects will be being built out in the fourth quarter, should contribute to helping achieve the 2012 forecast of 3.2 gigawatts. Beyond 2012, GTM Research expects to see continued growth in 2013, 2014, and all the way through 2017. With that, I'll turn it back to Roan.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. Now we'll hear from John Abe, Senior Vice President at NextAmp. John?
Thank you. I'm proud to be calling from the fourth largest solar market based on quarter three. I'm located here at NextAmp in Boston, Massachusetts, and I'd like to thank SIA and GTM for hosting this event and keeping a finger on the pulse of the rapidly changing solar market. Just a couple seconds on NextAmp. We were founded in 2006, and we are the largest solar company headquartered in Massachusetts with offices across the Northeast. We have installed over 25 megawatts of solar and have about 75 megawatts under development across the Northeast. Our clients range from General Mills to the University of Massachusetts to the U.S. Army. And we have about 50 employees, and during peak construction season, plan to be employing another 200 to 300 subcontractors. So fast forwarding to slide two, you know, I want to use this opportunity to take a minute to provide an industry perspective on how Massachusetts emerged from less than a 5 megawatt market in 2008 to a 100 megawatt market in 2012. Going to slide three, you know, the key drivers for this transition is really a evolution from a rebate-based market to a market that's based on solar renewable energy certificates and allows for virtual net metering, which is the ability to generate utility cash credits at a solar project site and use those credits to offset the utility bill at another location. I believe that this is a policy that's relatively unique to Massachusetts in the extent that it's very easily applied and there's not very many restrictions on it. So going back in time to slide four, 2009. 2009 was a year that saw only a few megawatts installed across the state. It was primarily driven by a rebate program. Some examples that of projects that were installed include a 100 kilowatt project for Boston Sand and Gravel in Boston, Mass, and a 130 kilowatt project for Sunsetter Retractable Awnings, which is based here in Massachusetts. The limitations on the rebate program basically kept project size under 200 kilowatts. Moving forward to the next slide, 2010. This was the first year of the Solar Renewable Energy Certificate Program, which allowed for supported up to 400 megawatts of project. It's important to note that it took some time for that program to get off its feet, and also to note that the solar industry in Massachusetts was not immune from the recession, but that the state of Massachusetts directed significant federal stimulus in the solar, and utilities started to get involved in solar that year, which helped bridge the gap from the rebate program to the Solar Renewable Energy Certificate program. So this year we saw about 25 megawatts installed, but really only 12 megawatts were SREC driven. And a couple of the projects that NextAmp was a part of, we installed about a megawatt for National Grid, and we also did about 300 kilowatts of projects through a power purchase agreement with the Acton-Boxborough Regional School District. Moving to 2011, this is a year when SREC projects start to gain traction. And also, it was the year when most of the projects that were funded by the federal stimulus were installed. And it was really these federal stimulus-funded projects that helped pave the way for larger projects in terms of addressing the permitting issues, the interconnection challenges with doing more than your typical small residential and small commercial projects. So a couple examples of projects that NextAmp did was 1.6 megawatts for the Pitts Wastewater Treatment Plant, which was a stimulus-funded project. And then, you know, one of the first SREC or Solar Renewable Energy Certificate projects of significant size was also installed by NextAmp. That's 1.2 megawatts for E.H. Perkins, which is a sand and gravel company based in Sterling, Massachusetts. Then fast forwarding to 2012. This is a year where, according to GTM, and we concur, you'll see more than 90 megawatts of solar installed this year. We saw significant investment in both ground-mounted and rooftop projects. And a couple examples of projects that benefited from this are a project done by NextAmp in partnership with Cathartis Private Investments, 4.4 megawatt project at located at a former quarry site in Westford, Massachusetts, called Westford Solar. This is a project that not only benefited from the Solar Renewable Energy Certificate Program, but also from virtual net metering. And it is basically selling net metering credits to entities such as the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and MIT Lincoln Labs, and providing those institutions with significant savings as well as the project with a long-term steady revenue source. And this project was also funded in part with a loan from two large regional banks, Cambridge Savings Bank and Middlesex Savings Bank. And another example of the nature of rooftop projects changing is Barrett Distribution Center, a 600 kilowatt project in Franklin, Mass. That was just done through a cash purchase with NextAmp. And on to the next slide, solar PV growth in Massachusetts. Just a couple things to highlight here. Basically, as we look at the growth curve, we can see that SREC installations have gone from just over 10 megawatts in 2010 to potentially over 90 in 2012. And the other trend I'd like to note is that the percentage of these projects made up by projects that are 500 kilowatts or a megawatt and larger has significantly increased. So in 2011, only 30% of the total installed capacity was projects that are 500 kilowatts and larger. And in 2012, you'll see that it was over 65% of the projects installed to date are 500 kilowatts and larger. So moving forward to the last slide, what does that mean in terms of NextAmp's 2013 outlook for Massachusetts? While we believe residential and small commercial growth will remain steady, we believe that larger scale projects, both ground mounted and rooftop, that are 500 kilowatts and above will continue to dominate the market and gain market share. As other speakers have noted, PPAs will continue to see an increasing share of deals. And in Massachusetts, we have some interesting issues that I'd like to highlight in conclusion that we'll be keeping our eye on to see how they impact the Massachusetts market. You know, the first one is the interconnection queue. There are over 1,000 megawatts of solar and other renewable energy projects in the interconnection queue. And it's going to be interesting to see how these projects play out, impact the markets in 2013 and beyond. SREC oversupply. Similar to what has happened in other markets, Massachusetts has experienced an SREC oversupply in 2012 that will probably extend for a couple more years. And it'll be interesting to see how this impacts SREC pricing. And also, the final issue is net metering and SREC caps. These aren't unlimited. Net metering is capped at a certain percentage of load, and the current SREC market's only 400 megawatts. So we'll be tracking closely how quickly these fill up, especially now that there's an opportunity to lock in a space in either the net metering queue or the SREC queue a year or more in advance of having to build your project. And in conclusion, I'd like to just point out that NextAmp is pleased to announce that soon we'll be breaking ground on a 6-megawatt project that we're doing in partnership with the Boy Scouts of America at their Treasure Valley Scout Reservation, which is located in central Massachusetts. This is a project that will not only provide a significant revenue stream to the Boy Scouts, but also provide savings to a number of local communities through the virtual net metering transactions. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'd like to hand it back to Roan.
Thanks very much, John. I really appreciate your overview. And I think so often in these presentations, we go through and throw out big numbers and megawatts and gigawatts, but putting a face on these projects, you know, kind of real companies throughout Massachusetts who are going solar, I think it really helps illustrate the fact that solar is becoming mainstream, not just early adopters, but that literally, you know, the companies that make up really the foundation of our economy and a lot of these local communities are going solar because it makes good economic sense. So thanks for that overview. Just as a reminder, John's slides are available on our website, which is www.seia.org/SMI. I apologize, I said backward slash before, but it's actually /SMI. But if you go there, you can also find our fact sheets, some more charts, the executive summary, and all sorts of good information. And now I'd like to turn it over to our final speaker, who is Nat Kramer, and CEO of Clean Power Finance. Nat?
Thanks, Ron. Good morning, everybody. It's a little foggy in San Francisco, but otherwise a great morning for solar. Clean Power Finance is an online marketplace connecting companies selling, installing, supplying, and financing solar systems. Our financing is predominantly for residential consumers in the form of PPAs, leases, and loans, and we have over $500 million in project financing available, which more than 140 companies sell to consumers in Arizona, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. Because the market for residential solar is relatively small in terms of the addressable market, this operates like a supply function market. So the more capital that you put into the market, the more demand shows up because consumers save money on their electricity bills when they go solar with clean power. We see large supplies of low-cost capital helping drive market penetration in residential solar. Specifically, we've seen additionally hundreds of millions of financing coming to the market from large power companies and banks. This capital is more competitive than what we've seen in the past. In the past, we've seen capital coming more from private equity sources who required higher returns. Large power companies and banks are providing capital at lower returns because they have a lower cost of capital. So, for example, in 2011, a typical investor for residential solar would demand returns on a portfolio basis, unlevered after tax, in excess of 10%. This year, we see new capital coming to the market where investors are asking for returns that are less than 10%. And I think that's a sign that investors are beginning to, A, understand that this asset class is less risky, B, it's a great value proposition for the end consumer, and C, it's a great investment for them over the long term. And that has resulted in more investors coming into the marketplace as well as additional capital. That additional capital on the supply side of financing has resulted on the demand side of financing in an extreme growth in credit applications across our platform. So, for example, in 2012, quarter over quarter, we've seen demand for consumers as represented in terms of credit applications increase 30% quarter over quarter, and we're now seeing it in excess of $100 million routinely in a quarterly period. What that demonstrates is that more and more consumers recognize that A, they can save money on their electricity bills. B, that companies that are selling and installing solar are getting out to the market in an effective fashion and reaching customers with that value proposition. And C, that investors are supplying financing that makes residential solar accessible so that more consumers can save money on their electricity bills with clean solar electricity. We're also seeing a trend in the marketplace towards specialization, where more companies are making the decision to focus on either selling solar and effectively refinancing consumer electricity bills, B, focusing on lower cost, high quality installation, or C, focusing on financing. So we see more and more of our customers who are effectively saying, let me figure out what I am good at. Am I really good at acquiring customers at low cost and high volume? Am I really good at installing systems at high quality, low cost, and high volume? And so as a consequence, we're seeing people specialize. And companies that are an example of that are companies like Integrated Electrical Services, which is an electrical contractor who's come into the industry and been able to offer contract installation services to companies like Duthie Renker, who operates in the industry and is purely focused on selling solar systems. So as the market matures, we see more and more industry participants coming from outside the industry who bring specific competencies in high customer acquisition at low cost, as well as high volume installation at high quality and low cost. And that is resulting in the general trend that Andrew noted, which is that the cost of installed systems is declining across the market. We see the market as being one that is getting more competitive across the country in all the markets where we operate and provide financing, but also in markets where people use our software. So our software is used in all 50 states. And so as a consequence, we think that's really exciting for the solar industry, but poses a challenge to specific participants inside the solar industry to focus their strategy on what they can be great at as we expand this market and deliver a value proposition to consumers that is terrifically compelling. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ron.
Thank you very much, Nat. Great overview. We will now open up the lines to reporters' questions, so I am going to turn it over to our operator, Mary, who can explain how each of you can ask a question. Mary?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question or have a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. This will place your question in the order it was received. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad now.
So while we're waiting for questions, and I think Nat and John did a very good job kind of providing their perspective with respect to trends, I'd like to actually ask a question to Andrew. What trends are you seeing in the forecast by market segment when you look out over the next couple of years?
Sure. Thanks, Ron. I think one major trend that you hit on, and then Nat, of course, spoke about is the prevalence of third-party-owned systems, especially in the residential space. It's also in the commercial space, but to a lesser extent, it really varies from market to market. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, in major residential markets, California, Arizona, New Jersey, Colorado, penetration rates are up above 75, 80% or 90% in some cases. In Massachusetts, it's growing steadily as well. For a lot of homeowners, despite system costs coming down on the whole from, you know, $35,000 last year to about $30,000 this year for the average size system, it's not really a financially tenable option right now. But the ability to lower one's energy costs with no money up front is very appealing to many homeowners, even if, you know, they could feasibly pay for a solar system outright. It also takes the worry of monitoring the system and ensuring that it's working properly out of the equation. And, of course, the solar provider also tracks the system's output because they have a stake in the system as well. So it ensures proper function of the system and really delivering the best product possible to the homeowner and ensuring that they realize electricity cost savings. On the non-residential front, John also touched on something interesting. Here in Massachusetts, virtual net metering, or the ability to wheel power from a solar installation to a remote location within the state, is very attractive for a lot of smaller municipalities who may not be able to install a system on their own, but in aggregate with some other smaller communities or municipalities, they can tap into a larger solar resource and purchase a smaller subset of that system's output, which allows for greater economies of scale when building the installation, thus making it easier to finance, and also allows the developer to reach out to more communities and provide solar as a low-cost option to the grid price alternative.
Fantastic. Right. Thanks. I'll turn it over to you, Mary, for questions.
Thank you, Roan. We will now take our first question. Our first question comes from Mike Grunwald from Time. Mike, please proceed with your question.
Hey, thanks for doing this, guys. You guys mentioned that in places with, you know, that in California and Arizona, the rebates have gotten very low. I'm wondering at what point, how low do costs need to get to be truly cost competitive with, say, you know, natural gas or coal? And can, if you could give a little, you know, history of how far they've come down since maybe 08, 09, and then how much further they still need to go.
This is Andrew.
Yeah, Andrew, if you want to give the macro stats, I can give some anecdotes that will help put some color behind that.
Absolutely. And, Mike, so you asked, you know, with regard to rebates and the cost of electricity generated by coal or natural gas. When we're looking at rebates, those are largely only really relevant to residential and non-residential installations, which have to compete with retail electricity prices. And while certainly natural gas and coal factor into those, it's less a competitor than when you compare it to the utility side, and I'll let Roan speak about that. But at the very high level, for example, the average installed price of a residential solar system in the first quarter of 2010 was $6.95 a watt. In Q3 2012, the average installed price of a residential solar system was $5.21 a watt. In markets such as Arizona that have low power costs and very low rebates at this point, it's not uncommon to see a residential solar system installed for $4 a watt or even less in some cases. So prices are coming down very quickly and are allowing solar to remain competitive even in the face of lower rebates.
Matt?
Yeah, I'd give the quick stat. The first PPA was done at almost $9 a watt in California in 2007, and today we routinely see prices in California that are sub $5, and at sub $5, they are not using, and I think Andrew hit this, the California Solar Initiative because the economics are good enough with the customer cash flows and the investment tax credit that they don't need to go through the paperwork filing hassle.
Well, what is what are the installed costs for other types of for fossil fuels? You said the 30, but you still use the 30% ITC. What would it take? What would it take for that not to be necessary?
This is Roan. Let me just kind of start by saying it's important to recognize that all energy technologies receive some form of support from the federal government.
Right.
And there's no doubt that oil and natural gas and the coal industries have not only received very large subsidies and support, but have received them for a long period of time. And frankly, most of their incentives are actually permanent. And so when we talk about being cost competitive, we really have to play into the fact that we're trying to establish a level playing field with respect to the same kind of support that the oil and gas industry has. And so we often refer to the ITC, but the ITC just begins to try to create that level playing field as opposed to giving us some kind of competitive advantage. I think the other very important point to make is that we really should be talking about the levelized cost of energy, not the installed cost of these technologies, because ultimately it's over a 20 or 30-year time frame that the consumer or the utility or whoever the off-taker is of the electricity is really benefiting from the lower costs of solar. And I think everybody would agree that although we have low natural gas prices today, no one expects those to remain at those levels for the near future. In fact, the EIA says that within 2 to 3 years, the natural gas prices are going to fully double from where they are at this point. So looking at the full, 20 to 30 year life cycle of these investments is ultimately the way that we need to compare solar and natural gas. And when you do so, you're finding that in many segments of the country, the LCOE for solar is lower than natural gas based on the forecast of natural gas prices coming out of the government. So, you know, again, for everybody who's on the phone, important to look more at how much it costs over a long period of time, which you're going to have this system operating versus just the upfront costs, simply because there is no fuel with a solar system. There's very little maintenance, and so there's a huge advantage to operating a solar system from a cost perspective compared to a traditional fossil power plant.
I'd add one thing to what Ron said, which is that when you look at gas versus solar, there's also a complement in terms of the solar, especially used when it's distributed generation, puts less taxing on the grid. And there's a lot of great research out of EPRI that follows this in countries that have high distributed generation from renewables and how that's actually reduced effectively how the grid is taxed. And if you look at investments that utilities have to make in upgrading their grid infrastructure so that they can support more wholesale generation, in general, I think when you look at that plus natural gas and what's happening in the natural gas market, it is highly unlikely that you'll see retail prices for electricity decline over the next 3 to 5 years.
Hey, Mike, this is Tom Kimbus from SEIA. Very quickly, I can send you after this call some work that's been done by Lazard out of New York, where they actually have done some in-depth research of, you know, all the fossil fuels as well as renewable energy on a cents per kilowatt hour and how that's changed over time.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Mike. Mary, if we could have the next question.
Sure. Our next question comes from Donna Howell with Investors Business Daily. Donna, please proceed with your question.
Hi. Thanks very much for having the call. I wanted to ask in particular what you're seeing for the array of installation companies out there that address the residential market. Did you rank those companies in size this quarter at all, or do you have any other feedback along those lines?
Andrew, do you want to take that?
Sure. Hi, Donna. In the SEIA GTN Research U.S. Solar Market Insight reports, we do not rank companies specifically. So that, unfortunately, is not in the report. But the macro trends hold true for a number of the market leaders. And I think I'll let maybe Nat discuss a little bit more of that as he's directly tied into the space, and that's exactly what his company does. But amongst residential installers, the top five installation companies, these are the firms that actually install panels on the roofs, control about 30% of the national market. So we are seeing really market leaders emerge. I mean, there are more than 2,000 companies actively installing solar in the U.S., but for five companies to hold about 30% of market share of the residential market really sets them, sets them apart from the average installer. They have significantly wider marketing outreach, lower installed costs in many cases, and have raised significant funding from institutional investors as well. So we look for them to really be market leaders in many of the mature state markets.
Yeah, I can add a little color to that. So we see very large companies like SolarCity and Varengo, which are the largest in the marketplace, operating in multiple markets, selling thousands of systems to consumers routinely. We also see an expansion of smaller companies that are more local, operating in the industry, and that are supported by value-added resellers like Soligent and Sunwise, which for whom the parent company of Soligent is Itochu, a large Japanese concern, and Sunwise parent is Mitsui, a large concern there. So what you're seeing is innovative business models that where people are able to support a value chain of smaller local companies to give them the resources to compete with larger companies. We see that across the board, but in general, we see a trend towards expansion among all sectors, whether you're a small installer that's partnered with larger organizations to get services so that you can compete with larger organizations like a SolarCity or Varengo. But across the board, we see every segment, whether you're small, medium, or one of the larger companies, growing quite quickly in this marketplace.
Great, thank you. Can you take a follow-up question?
Sure.
Okay, and this is just in general. While incentives have been coming down in states, if you can clarify for me how reliant on the ITC is the residential installation market in the U.S., and for the foreseeable future, will that change?
So the investment tax credit as a component of the capital structure for investors who are providing financing is very important today. I think that what you see is a trend towards investors working on debt to put into their products so that they can become less reliant on it over time. We think that financing would be more constrained if you didn't have the investment tax credit, and you would find a much more illiquid market, and that would cause, I think, a real problem in the growth of the industry, and it would be very unfortunate since we're helping, average American families save money on their electricity bills every day. So it's a fantastic vehicle from a incentive standpoint to create a private public partnership. So you've got a consumer who's saving money in their electricity bill from clean solar power that is local. You've got an investor who has to put capital at risk to be able to earn the investment tax credit. And so you end up having a market-based mechanism that is really driving in the U.S. The adoption of solar and really driving more competition in this industry, which I think is a great result. And I'd contrast that with incentive structures that have been used for solar in other markets like the feed-in tariff, which did not have that effect of building a healthy industry. And I think here we have that today, and it's been very important and will continue to be for the foreseeable future.
Thank you.
Hey, Donna, this is Roan. Just to put a little bit of context, especially for the rest of the listeners on the call, the investment tax credit was created in 2005 in the energy bill, really didn't start until 2006, and then we only had it for 2 years, and then we had it for a one-year extension. And so it really wasn't until the Toxic Asset Relief Program, the TARP bill in 2008, in which we had a longer period of time, and that was an eight-year incentive. So our tax credit is in place through the end of 2016 for both residential and commercial installations. It's great to see that it actually is working. It's working extremely well. We are not in the same situation as those technologies who rely on the production tax credit, which expires at the end of this year. And we are very confident that our tax credit will remain in place through 2016, and we're working with Congress to find a long-term options afterwards. So, ultimately, what's important for, I think, the industry is policy stability. Congress created it when they extended the ITC for eight additional years. But I think with all large investments, as Nat has described, it's critical that the government not only provide that certainty, but that level playing field that exists with the other fossil technologies with which we need to compete. Mary, if we could have the next question.
Sure. Our next question comes from John Hurdle with the New York Times. John, please proceed with your question.
Hi, good morning. Just an overarching policy question for you here. You mentioned, I guess this is for Roan, you mentioned policy in your introductory remarks, and I'm wondering how dependent the future growth of the solar industry is on the policy environment in general, and what specific policies are you looking for from all levels of government?
Thanks, John. Great question. So I would say that what's most important for our industry is that we have access to the electricity marketplace. And what has existed historically is you have a government-protected monopoly that has limited the ability of competition to occur within their utility districts. That is a state law. And what we are working on as an industry collectively across the entire country is to establish full retail net metering laws as well as standardized interconnection laws that allow us to compete in the electricity marketplace, regardless of if you're a homeowner or you're a business owner or if you're developing solar power plants. But what is fundamental and what we think is consistent with a free market system is that we be allowed to compete in the electricity marketplace. Without that, it's extremely difficult. That is not a subsidy. That is just purely modifying the policies that were designed by the utilities to protect their monopoly interests and to create competition. And I think we would all agree that with greater competition, you're going to see a lower price for the consumer. It's going to benefit society overall. Looking at the incentive side, I think Andrew and John and Nat did a very good job in describing how we have scaled up this industry, and it has, as we've scaled up, we've seen the costs come down significantly. In many cases, the costs have come down for solar while electricity rates for consumers have gone up due to fluctuations previously in natural gas, but obviously in coal and in other technologies. And so increasingly solar is cost competitive. The 30% tax credit is right now fundamental for this industry, but it's really a partnership between the federal government and states that create a solar market. And I think John did a very good job in describing what's going on in Massachusetts, but we see that in other states. And so when you look at states that haven't created net metering or interconnection rules or any other type of kind of stimulus incentive, there's a very small and limited solar market. But those who have created these rules, like Maryland, are seeing huge economic investments occur in their states. But as the industry continues to scale up and prices come down, it gives the state the ability to lower the incentive or to let the market-based structures like SRECs take over and provide that that form of support for the industry. Any of the other participants want to answer that question?
I think the California market, I think the California market incentive structure was designed to step down as the market size grew, and that's exactly what's happened, and it's been effective. And so you've gone from that first PPA deal that I discussed in 2007 being close to $9 a watt, literally to being cut in half in terms of pricing, in terms of the market. So the California Solar Initiative, I think, in the residential marketplace has been very effective in doing in a specific way exactly what Ron has said, in a macro way for the whole U.S.
Hey, this is also Tom Kimbis from SEIA. Just wanted to chime in with one point. We have a there's a report that was put out earlier this year by the Howard Baker Center at the University of Tennessee, and it was specifically looking at some of the questions that some of the members of the press have asked on this call, namely, what is the value of the ITC, and how does it really compare to other incentives that are out there for other energy sources? And that should be available up on our SEIA website. If for some reason it's not, we're happy to send it out, but last I checked, it was out there. And it examines historically how energy incentives have been important for creating benefits for our economy, and how solar really is not an anomaly. Instead, it's actually very consistent with how other energy sources have in the past and continue to have incentives that help drive drive our economy.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Next question, Mary.
All right. It looks like there are no further questions in the queue.
Okay. Can you remind people how to ask a question, Mary?
Absolutely. If you do have a question or would like to make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad now.
Okay. Well, is there any more questions, Mary?
There is one more question from Gloria Gonzalez with Environmental Finance. Gloria, go ahead with your question.
Hi, Ron. I just wanted to follow up on the ITC. So you see it as being safe through 2016, even though there's talk that there will be a major tax overhaul. Could the solar ITC become a part of that if that does come to fruition?
We don't anticipate that it will, in large part because it's a program that's only in place for a short period of time. I think when you look at fundamental corporate tax overhaul, you're looking at permanent incentives, you're looking at some of the things that have become embedded and ingrained, if you will, in our tax code. With an incentive that's in place for a short period of time, it's very typical that you would not see that as part of the package. Having said that, though, obviously we're spending a significant amount of time educating members of Congress on the value of the investment tax credit, how it has worked to stimulate investment in this industry, how the industry is scaling up and costs are coming down. I think we're all, want to make sure that as we engage in discussions around fundamental corporate tax reform, that those types of tax credits or other segments of the code that really deliver positive economic growth for our economy are kept in place. And we certainly hear that support echoed by members of Congress when we have our meetings with them. So we're doing our work to make sure it stays in place, that's for sure. Okay. Mary, are there any more questions?
No, there are no further questions at this time.
With that, I'd just like to thank everyone for dialing in, and I'd especially like to thank our speakers for participating. For more information about the Solar Market Insight Report, it can be found on SEIA's website, again, www.seia.org. As a reminder to everyone, this call has been recorded and will be available within 24 hours. If you would like to link to this recording or have any questions that you didn't get a chance to ask or want to follow up with us or any of the speakers, please contact Jamie Nolan of SEIA's communications team at 202-556-2886. Again, Jamie Nolan, 202-556-2886. Thanks again for joining us today. Have a great day and look forward to our fourth quarter and end-of-year Solar Market Insight coming out shortly in 2013. Thanks, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this will conclude our conference. Thank you for joining us today.